Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
You're listening to the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and a member of the Christians for Liberty Network. Are America's colleges and universities still places where critical thought and debate are flourishing? And if not, can they be again? My guest today is Jennifer Townsend. Jennifer Townsend is the executive assistant to the dean of the Lee Honors College at Western Michigan University. She holds master's degrees in comparative religion and spirituality, culture, and health. That's one thing. Comparative religion is one thing. Spirituality, culture, and health is the other thing.
Yes.
A lot of ands and commas there. Just want to make sure.
Yes, thanks.
And you teach part-time for the Honors College, as well as the Departments of Philosophy and World Religions and Cultures. Jennifer's research is focused on death and dying and our ideas of the sacred in the U.S. and 21st century. Jennifer, that's such an interesting topic. I should have done more questions on that. We're talking about the Heterodox Academy stuff, which is something you're doing where you serve as the co-chair of the Heterodox Academy campus community at Western Michigan University. You also work to promote free speech and viewpoint diversity on your campus through Heterodox Academy, and I'm assuming also in your own way. She, along with her two co-chairs, were awarded the 2025 Heterodox Academy Open Inquiry Award for Community Excellence for their work at Western Michigan University. So thank you, Jennifer, for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, tell me a little about your background and your teaching focus and the stuff related to religion and spirituality and death and dying in particular. This sounds really interesting. So what got you involved in that kind of work?
You know, people always ask me why I study death and dying, and I never really have a good answer for that. I think, you know, being sort of raised feral as a Gen X kid where you were responsible for your own life and death every day for most of the day kind of changes the way you look at death and dying. And
so you're blaming lawn darts for this, or
entirely? Yes. Yeah. The falling out of trees, lawn darts, roaming the streets till dark. Yes. but it is an important topic. It is especially important as I think we have lost our way religiously, spiritually. We don't talk about death and dying. We sort of outsource the entire thing from the moment that we realize we're dying until we're in the ground or cremated or whatever. And so why is that? Why are we just handing that off? And why are we okay with that? Why is there so much ambivalence around it? Why are we not prepared for it? You know, all of those questions. So the course that I teach on that is called Death, Dying, and Beyond. I did not develop the course. It was developed by Dr. Cynthia Vischer in what was then the Department of Comparative Religion. I have created an honors section of that for my college based on Cindy's original concept and put my own spin on it a little bit. And so I teach students about death and dying and death practices in different cultures and religions throughout the world.
Well, and maybe this is sort of a basic level question, but sort of like asking an economist if they've ever read Adam Smith. But as you were talking about that, I was thinking of Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, which got me really thinking about that subject. And I think it really is a stepping stone for thinking about spirituality in relation to meaning and its relationship to life, to dying, to, you know, what keeps us going. There was a lot there, and this kind of logotherapy approach. And I'm assuming you're at least familiar with that work, but
yes.
Anyway, well, okay. So, what got you interested in philosophy in particular?
It was sort of accidental, really. I was leading a book group on campus on Jonathan Haidt's The Righteous Mind, and I was talking to my friend Dave, who is Dave Paul, who is the chair of the philosophy department and my co-chair now of the Heterodox Academy campus community. And the way that I had structured the sort of group read of the book, I thought, well, I could really turn this into a class. And I was talking to Dave about it a little bit, and he said, yeah, that would be great with philosophy and public affairs under this umbrella here. And so I kind of, from there, that's what happened. And I created a 3-credit course in this philosophy and public affairs umbrella based on the Righteous Mind is our main text. And we read a few other things, some John Stuart Mill. We read Irshad Manji's Don't Label Me and some other things. And the course is designed to introduce moral foundations theory and then to help students understand how to communicate and understand each other across ideological, moral, political divides. And then I threw in a healthy dose of why the First Amendment is so important in all of these areas and why we all need free speech and where we would be without it. Of course, a lot of stuff happening in the world today is would have been perfect for my semester in the fall. But I do try to pull from things that are happening around us to show students where, you know, this is why you need to stand up for these rights. This is why you need to communicate with each other. This is why you need to have conversations rather than shouting each other down and canceling each other out. So all of that to say, I kind of stumbled into philosophy. It is not my background at all. I am now have begun an interdisciplinary PhD in philosophy and comparative religion. So I'm kind of merging my two interests there, although still mainly focusing on death and dying.
That's cool. Yeah, well, and, you know, Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, is such an interesting one. I'm sure there's a lot of folks who already are familiar with it. But what was fascinating about what he did with that project was coming from a place where he is a liberal and he's sort of used to thinking about political issues through this kind of moral liberal lens. And then he becomes aware that there are actually these, like you said, these different moral foundations, these kind of, building blocks or whatever that people use when they're thinking about moral issues. And he would sort of do these like thought experiments. So like he sort of argued that on the left, there's primarily this sort of concern for like fairness. Is that the correct one? Or is it something sort of like that?
Care and fairness, the sort of argument between equality and meritocracy and things like that.
And so, you know, a lot of times people on the right are just kind of motivated by different sort of questions. So, and what he sort of pointed out was that people on the left are too. I guess I'm kind of on the left in a way, in the sense that libertarianism could be considered a left-wing movement. But people on the left they have some of those same moral foundations. So anyway, just to give like the example that he sort of commonly used was like a thought experiment of like a brother and sister who are considering committing incest, and they're you know, going to use protection, blah, blah, blah. There's no ill effects that are likely to come out of it. Is it wrong? Right. And then people on the left and right both say it is, but the people on the left have trouble justifying it. And so what he sort of pointed out was this sort of idea of, is it the sanctity foundation, or do you have another term for it? Something like that, this kind of idea.
Yeah, sanctity. Yeah.
Sanctity. And so it was really interesting. And what happened as a result of him thinking through those issues was he realized that conservatives had more to offer to the conversation than he had initially thought.
Yes.
And I thought that was a very honest conclusion for him to come to. Are you familiar with Arnold Kling's book, The Three Languages of Politics? Is that one that you looked at some?
I am not familiar with that one, no.
He's a libertarian. He does this kind of a similar sort of thing, but it's he talks about how the left, right, and libertarians see the world through sort of three different dichotomies. The right sees it through a sort of an order chaos or civilization chaos dichotomy. The left sees it through a oppressor-oppressed dichotomy. And then libertarians see things in the freedom coercion sort of lens. And so when you apply that to politics, you understand why the right looks at something like police brutality differently than the left does, because they're just fundamentally seeing it through a different vantage point. But
yeah,
all those questions are really interesting. Sorry, I don't want to hijack where we're going to go with this conversation. I'm just interested in all these little topics. One of the things that you've talked about, the Heterodox Academy, that Heterodox Academy is really interested in, is viewpoint diversity. So for those who are not familiar with what viewpoint diversity is, can you sum that up?
It's that the most basic level, it's, you know, different people with different opinions in the same room together. That's viewpoint diversity. If I think Diet Coke is better than Diet Pepsi and you think Diet Pepsi is better, well, there we go. We have diverse viewpoints on that. I mean, it's not a complicated concept.
Yeah.
But people overcomplicate it by attaching sort of political or ideological meaning to what we mean when we say viewpoint diversity.
Well, and so as we talk about diversity, we're thinking in terms of ethnic diversity, gender diversity, sexual orientation diversity. And maybe not to be aware about being unfair in some sense, but sometimes with some folks on the left, what they kind of want to hear is more or less the same opinion coming from different people, people of color, different people of different sexual orientations or whatever. And so this is, the focus here is less about, what's your ethnicity? What's your gender? It's more about what's your point of view? Do you have something interesting to contribute to the conversation that'll get us thinking more, in more complex ways about this subject? Do you feel that viewpoint diversity should replace things like intentionally hiring for ethnic or gender diversity in academic settings, or would you say that both have some value?
I think it would be incredibly simplistic of me to say, yes, absolutely. And for the most part, I do think, yes, absolutely. I do believe that there is merit in ethnic, in sexual diversity, in all of those areas, because all of those aspects, all of those immutable characteristics do contribute to how you see the world. They do help shape your viewpoint. But if you're choosing people based on those immutable characteristics and only those immutable characteristics, then that's not, you see, I'm even having trouble articulating it. Really, because you can't just say we just had MLK, Martin Luther King Day, based on the content of your character, not the color of your skin. If you're just saying, well, I want you in my department because you're a woman, what does that really contribute? It might be 1/10 of what makes up my entire worldview. And it might not have anything to do at all with what my research is into or what I'm studying or who I vote for or, the way that I think about anything may or may not be influenced. I'm sure it is slightly influenced by the fact that I'm a woman, but you can't say that we have diversity if you just have this array of people with different skin tones or different physical characteristics of some kind, or because you're gay and you're straight and you're whatever you are. That's not the way that you shape research. It's not the way that you shape policy. It's not the way that you shape the way that we view the world and problem solving. It's one piece of it, but it's not the whole thing. Now, if you are looking at ideas and you say, I'm researching death and dying. So we'll go with that. So if I say, well, we have all of these disparities between who's allowed hospice care, who can afford hospice care, who is allowed to die at home, who has to die in a hospital, who dies on the street. And it's all based on the fact that they are, whether you're homeless or whether you're Black or whether you're white or whether you're Hispanic or whether you're Asian, or how much money you have, and the solution is the government should fund everything, which I would never say, by the way, then I'm fitting into an ideological predisposition that everybody at the university is already leaning toward because everybody is super liberal, right? I'm kind of all over the place with this answer, and I, it's terrible. I sound like I don't know what I'm talking about.
I'm following you.
Okay, so my point is, if you have all of these people in the room who are these, for instance, white, liberal, middle-aged women who all think that the government needs to pay for everything because all of these people are poor and they don't have everything that they need. And you don't have anything to counter that. If you don't have anything to look at the broader picture, the bigger picture, that who's going to pay for it, where's the money going to come from? What if this is a different solution that might work better, but still solves the problem? Then nothing really gets solved. There's no progress there, yeah. Right? There's no...
Because you need different ideas bouncing off of each other and interacting so that you're not just sort of speaking to a room full of people who agree with you, right? So yes. So that would you then say that, you know, in thinking about as a maybe university is looking to fill some positions and they want to have some viewpoint diversity, they want to have some different perspectives, would you be okay with saying, you know, well, maybe gender or sexual orientation or ethnicity could factor into what it sort of means to be including different perspectives, but it's insufficient in and of itself to sort of count for creating a diverse staff, something like that? Or
yes, like that. But I mean, I don't want to run the risk either of saying that, you know, any identity group is a monolith, because it isn't. And I think that's an assumption that is made quite often, that, oh, you look this way, so you obviously think this way. You work at a university, so clearly you think this way, and I can trust right. that what I say in this room is going to be, you're going to nod along. It's an important factor. I don't know that it's as important a factor as everyone would like it to be. Right. I think that if you are aiming for diverse ideas, diverse perspectives, then the rest follows.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
No, it makes sense. Yeah. No, and you know, you certainly hear this perspective among, you know, folks on the left or whatever, that if you have a, when they say something, is the distinction that I've heard them say, like, well, it's not enough to have a black mouth, you also need a black voice. And so what they mean by that is, it's not enough that you are black, you have to be expressing what I think should be in your head as a black person, which is a fairly left-wing point of view, which is not actually accurate or correct.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of racist too, right? You look this way, so I'm assuming that this is how you think. And if you don't think, then mm-hmm. that's wrong.
Right. You've been brainwashed in some way. So you have, yeah. You have nothing to contribute to the conversation because you don't agree with me on everything. So, you know, when I was considering applying for a PhD, I asked some friends in the field if I should mention that I work with the Libertarian Christian Institute on my CV, and they advised me against it. And they said that they thought it actually might hurt my ability to get into a program. And I'm not, this is just about me. I'm just sort of using that as an example here. Do you think that they were right about the need to hide unpopular opinions to fit in with academia? Have your own heterodox viewpoints created challenges for you or others you know to advance within academia?
This is an answer you're probably not going to like, but it depends. It really does. I think my position is more unique than most because I'm not faculty, I'm adjunct. So even if I'm not allowed to teach anymore, I still have a full-time job. So that in itself is very different for me. I consciously made the choice to stop hiding my political views on campus and my moral views, my perspective across the board. I chose to stop hiding that and be very open about what I actually think about things. And I would, I began adding things to my CV that reflected those. So for a long time, I was the staff advisor for the Second Amendment group on campus, which was technically affiliated with the NRA. It was the NRA Collegiate Coalition. And my students won an award for their work on campus advocating for the Second Amendment. They won an award from the NRA. I was the staff advisor for the Young Americans for Liberty for several years. I have appeared on panels. I have just generally spoken out. I've made it known that I am available to students who feel like their voices are being suppressed or quieted or chilled in some way. And I've added all of those things to my CV. And to my knowledge, none of it has affected me negatively. I think part of that is because I was already staff there before I started speaking out. Part of it is because I've been respectful in voicing those opinions, and I have made sure that my students in these different groups have all treated others with respect and decency and invited them to conversations, not returned the vitriol or the hate and shouting other people down that they received. And I have been honestly unapologetic about it. Now, if you're going into academia, I can't say that you would be able to safely do the same thing just going in. And I think there is ample evidence that has been collected by various research groups over the last 20 or so years that proves that universities and higher education in general is very, very, very far to the left. And it is very not welcoming to middle-right conservative voices. I have been openly mocked on campus for my views. I've been mocked by people in the administration for my views. You have to have a thick skin, for sure. But it's offensive.
When you say mocked, I mean, is it kind of coming from a perspective, like these are sort of colleagues where it's sort of more joking, or do you feel it's been really dismissive?
I've very much been dismissed by one or two members of the administration when I was more libertarian than I am now. Very much mocked for, oh, you libertarians, you don't believe in this, you know, just silly, childish things, really. But you just have to shrug it off. You have to ignore it. And you keep going.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, all of that said, even if you don't share your perspective when you're trying to get into higher ed, the chances of getting into higher ed, at least in a faculty position, are slim to none anyway.
That's true.
So,
yep.
I'm not sure that you want to narrow that window even further by letting them know that you are not the progressive that they think you should be.
Right,
which is a shame.
Yeah. So someone who's a political and theological conservative should go ahead and do their PhD research on a queer reading of Mark or Luke anyway, just to be safe.
I wouldn't go that far.
Do you think that it's tougher for a Republican or a Christian to find work in maybe a tenure track position at a university? Do you feel is one going to be more of a challenge than the other? And just as a sense you've gotten,
yes, if you make your views known going in, I believe that to be the case for the majority of schools. Yes.
Do you feel like it'd be more difficult if you were sort of an open Republican or an open Christian to find a position?
That's a tough call. And right now, probably Republican.
Interesting. Yeah, I do. Under Trump, I could see that. I asked that question of George Yancey as well, as a sociologist who's done some research on in academia, kind of viewpoint discrimination. And the sense that he had sort of gotten at the time was that it was more difficult to be a Christian, that there was sort of just a sense, well, you know, you could sort of, you know, believe in small government and still be kind of a reasonable person. But if you had a kind of a religious commitment, then that made you suspicious, unless it was, you know, Islam or something. So, you know, as a libertarian myself, I think having the state manage wrongthink is a very dangerous proposition. And I also see how cancel culture can give bad ideas more light than they would have had otherwise. And I think, you know, Nick Fuentes is a good example of that. This guy who bounced back and, you know, much, much higher after being deplatformed. I also find myself maybe getting less and less confident that an atmosphere of completely open inquiry where no ideas are shamed will necessarily allow the best ideas to rise to the top. There's a sort of idea that, you know, well, if everybody talks, then the marketplace will sort it out. The best ideas will get picked, right? But it seems to me that a lot of people seem to be very attracted to a lot of really horrible ideas. And And then especially once those ideas get maybe attached to policy, they can be really destructive. And so are you optimistic about free inquiry's ability to strain out the bad ideas? And do you think that it's legitimate for a society or a discipline to treat some ideas as garbage and delegitimize their proponents? So, I mean, do you think we should keep a totally open perspective, or are there some lines that we have to sort of say, you know, you're not going to go to jail for this, but, you know, you're not going to be respected within your field?
Well, you can do both. Mm-hmm. You can have a totally open field of inquiry while making it clear that the idea that you're interrogating seems pretty ridiculous. And you can do it in a way that is respectful to the person presenting the foolishness of the ridiculous idea in order to sort of expose why it's such a bad idea. Now, you may not, and this is one thing that I tell my students, like you can't go in expecting to change people's minds, but if you have a conversation to try and better understand the idea that you think is insane, it kind of helps you lay out all of the reasons that it doesn't make sense and the reasons that it doesn't work. I'm not saying that it's always going to be 100% effective, but to go back to your example of Nick Fuentes, I mean, that man is garbage, right? There's no way, there's no reason, there's no logic behind why the Republican Party hasn't just blanket said, this man is garbage and he does not represent the vast majority of the people who belong to the Republican Party. Because why wouldn't you disavow this person just across the board? But again, like you said, because he's been shut down, and it happened with, who was it, Milo Yiannopoulos, Ben Shapiro, you know, a lot of the more, not that, I don't know, maybe Shapiro is not as extreme as some of these other voices, but the more you shut these things down, the bigger they get. So people are always going to believe stupid things because right. People are people. People are always going to attach themselves to ridiculous ideas. But if you don't have the conversations about them, then they're not going to be exposed as ridiculous.
You have to have those conversations.
It has to have, and there has to be open inquiry because it is the only, I think it's the only legitimate solution to bad ideas.
Well, and I think we're at a stage now where I think perhaps the left was a little too eager to use the kind of you're a racist argument when it wasn't legitimate. And so yeah. There's a lot of people on the right now who don't take it seriously and almost, you know, don't want to say the word even when it's completely accurate to use it. But I've seen, you know, I think I've seen this in the area of anti-Semitism in particular, where there's a sort of a technique that you'll find with like the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which is like, well, just label it anti-Semitic, right? And it's like, then that will shut it down. And it's like, well, no, sometimes you actually have to like engage with the argument. It may be a bad argument. It may be in bad faith. It may be missing a lot of details. And I know that it's a lot of work. It's a lot easier just to say, well, that's anti-Semitic than it is to actually demonstrate why some conspiracy theory is bogus. But like the unfortunate reality is like, if you actually want to change people's minds, if you want to take that donor money that's coming in and use it effectively, you don't just say, well, that's racist or that's anti-Semitic. You have to demonstrate why and why, what's wrong with the ideas that are being put out there.
Yes.
I mean, you mentioned Milo. I mean, Milo is such an interesting example of, I mean, kind of, that was pre-2020. That was pre-Trump, the first term, I think, even, where he was getting shouted down at universities. And then, you know, obviously things went kind of in an even weirder direction in 2020 with some of the stuff. But let's talk about listening to understand. So this is a phrase that you've used and has, you know, come out of Heterodox Academy and some of the work you've done there. Should this always be our goal in a disagreement, or is it okay to have as a primary consideration simply winning the argument?
Well, I mean, everybody's first instinct is to win the argument all the time, because everybody wants to win the argument. Everybody wants to be right, right? And I suppose there are instances where it is actually important to try and persuade the other person or the other entity that you are correct. I mean, like, this is the whole point of a court case or, you know, things like that. There are arenas and settings where that is appropriate. If you're having conversations with people, if you're talking to your cousin who is calling you a transphobe because you don't think that men in dresses belong in women's spaces, you're not going to win an argument with that person, right? So why would you waste your breath? If you want to understand that person's perspective, if you want to plant a seed in their mind as to why your perspective might not actually be transphobic, you have to have a conversation. So you start by inviting them to the table, and then you ask them to explain to you their perspective because you want to understand it better. And then you offer, well, here's why I see things the way that I do. You know, will you change their mind? Probably not. But are you going to be arguing about it over Thanksgiving dinner? Also, probably not, because you've had a civil conversation with each other about it. You might understand each other better. You may still think each other, you might still think your cousin's an idiot. She might still think you're an idiot, whatever. But you still have a relationship there. You still are able to get along with each other because you understand each other. And this is true for almost everyone. It's not true for everyone. Every conversation will not go smoothly. But if you start with the intent to understand and not to win, then you're going to make more progress than if your whole goal is to own that other person.
Yeah, you don't want to set up a prove me wrong table at Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, I've thought about this a little bit in the context of, you know, if you're debating before you understand, then you're not really having a productive conversation anyway. You're not really engaging with them. You're just kind of venting your frustration at some sort of imagined opponent. And right. So even as a tactic to win a debate, listening, I think, should be considered really important, because what you're doing is you're listening to say, well, what is their perspective? Do I agree with it? Do I not agree with it? Do I see something wrong with it? Is there something I could learn from here? And that, I think, you know, if your approach is simply to win a debate, regardless of the data, regardless of what's right or wrong, regardless of what the facts on the ground are, then I guess you don't necessarily, it doesn't matter that much if you listen. But if you're wanting to understand what the other person's saying, and then you can respond to it, you can find points of agreement, points of disagreement. One thing I've heard people say, and I've tried to do this, and I try to be aware of it when I'm not doing it, which is this sort of tendency that most people, when we're having a conversation, we're just waiting for the other person to stop talking so we can interject what we're thinking.
Yes.
And that, yes. You know, and you know, there's that temptation, well, I gotta be focused on my talking point because I'm going to forget it if I don't do it. And I get that a little bit, but but at the end of but if you're having a conversation, it is supposed to be a dialogue, and there should be things that you're considering that the other person is saying, or else it's not a very fruitful conversation. So there's a lot to think about there. A few years ago, there was a strong narrative of decline in higher education, that higher education was not what it used to be. And in particular, when it came to things like open discourse, welcoming different viewpoints. And you've given me some indication that maybe things are not still what they ought to be. do you think that compared to, in 2020, when this was a big conversation point, a few years leading up to that, do you think higher education is in a better place, a worse place, or about the same?
I don't have numbers to back this up. I can only speak anecdotally. From my experience on campus and knowing and having conversations with folks on other campuses, it is not better. I would say it's worse. I think, you know, my little group is doing our best to at least promote different ideas, but I don't see... You know, so many of the disciplines are predominantly very far to the left and without specifically looking for people who are conservative or Republican or even libertarian, that's not going to change. There's no motivation really for people center, center right, far right to go into academia. The money's not great, for one thing. And the environment has made it seem incredibly unwelcoming to those people. So why would you subject yourself to that? Why do I subject myself to that? I don't know that it will improve, really, unless you're looking at a school like Hillsdale or University of Austin. Is that new one? University of Austin?
Yeah, I don't know.
Like Liberty University, the places that are either designed, like University of Austin, which is designed to be intellectually diverse, or like schools that are just by their nature in the opposite direction, where it's very, very far to the right.
Not necessarily open to all viewpoints, but different viewpoints are predominant, right? Yeah, like the conservative Wesleyan Bible College I went to.
Yes.
Yes. and you know, Elon Musk recently highlighted some data that showed that an elite university's faculty were like 89% to 99% Democrats. And, you know, obviously that creates a sense in which people are very suspicious of what's coming out of the of universities, that they send their kids there, they're going to come back with, you know, blue hair and a Marxist and some new pronouns or whatever. And I mean, first of all, are those parents right? and second of all, thinking about this kind of the future of higher education in general, this is something I think about a lot because, you know, I value academia in principle. And, you know, there's, you know, the back of my head, there's sort of like, yeah, you know, I would enjoy doing that kind of work or whatever. I mean, there's the scholarly community and, you know, is important, I think, sure, to any discipline. But, you know, I'm also seeing where, you know, the internet has made it possible to, you know, pick up a lot of information and to sort of form sort of adjunct, you know, these sort of, you know, ad hoc communities. So do you think that there's an alternative that's a meaningful alternative that could end up displacing higher education, and will it if we don't restore confidence in our educational institutions?
I think higher ed will always exist. I think that it will persist in its leftward leaning, despite any government attempt at intervention there, which is a whole other line of conversation. But I think that with things like what's the University of Edinburgh has all of those courses that are freely available to online. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much that, and I am a classic autodidact. I mean, most of what I know about anything is because I was curious and I picked up a book. I think there are so many ways for people to get an education that does not require them to attend a university or go into massive debt or be in an environment where they're not comfortable or may not feel welcome, or they may not want their kids to be in this environment. There's so many other ways to become an educated person. And there are so many ways to define what educated really means. Mm-hmm. You know, the trade schools, you know, I come from a long, proud line of plumbers who plumbers rule the world. Where would we be without the plumbers? But there were so many generations, there were the two or three generations of folks who were like, no, you must go to college. You must get a four-year degree. The trades are terrible. And now there's a shortage of tradespeople. So there are so many different ways.
And too many people with master's degrees who can't find work.
Exactly. So there's so many different ways to say, this is what an education means to me and my family. This is the way that I can achieve this education. And that does not necessarily mean that you have to go to a 4-year or a 2-year university or beyond that to a grad school and then further grad school, because your master's degree doesn't do anything for you because you have to get a PhD, and then your PhD doesn't do anything for you because who's going to hire a PhD?
The credential inflation paradox, right?
Yes, exactly. So,
do you think that because of that over time, because it seems like higher education was always kind of something that was available primarily to kind of the top tier or whatever you want to call that. And then we've tried to sort of say, well, everybody should have that experience. Everybody should be, you know, upper middle class or more. And, you know, you're not doing your kid any favors if you're not putting them in that position to, you know, sit at a desk somewhere. I mean, do you feel that that's going to recede, that we're going to kind of go back to where it was before, that as we have more opportunities for people in the middle to get something like a meaningful education without spending the money, that we'll just have less and less people in that sort of middle place seeking after that?
I think so. I think that it's a tiny bit of that is happening right now. I think that we're, and this is, again, I don't have numbers with me, but I think there has been a very small increase in young people who have chosen trade school rather than going to the 4-year university or college. And I think that that will continue to increase. And I think that's it's fantastic.
Yeah.
I've encouraged my own children to go into the trades rather than to go to university. And so my son he's 11. He's going to be a welder. That's all he wants to do.
I've got a 13-year-old daughter. She feels the same way.
And that's amazing because you will be able to write your own paycheck, essentially. But I think that that will continue to increase. Of course, this is not my area of expertise, so I can only tell you based on personal experience and what I'm seeing at the university and seeing, you know, with my family and with the trades. I think that's the case, and I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you know, I've tried to kind of think in terms of not knowing what the future holds and having, you know, young kids that, you know, so far we're kind of homeschooling. And so it's like, okay, well, by the time they're 18, I want them to have at least a few skills that they have under their belt. And maybe a couple of them can be impractical. So like that 13-year-old daughter who wants to be a welder, who I'm definitely going to send to, you know, the high school trade school to do that, also is doing a stop motion animation class, right? And, you know, chances are she's probably not going to be a successful stop motion animation person, not because of talent, just because of how difficult it is, you know, to succeed in that kind of line of work, and it's very niche. But she'll have that as an option. She'll have this other thing as an option. And so, you know, that's kind of, and then before college even enters the conversation. And so I think it's important to have kids, and also kids who are highly literate, which is another wild topic that's going on, which is that if for the best, the kids raised under the, you know, new reading method that's not phonics are apparently not graduating high school knowing how to read.
That's astonishing to me.
Yeah. Well, so I want to talk a little, moving away just from the kind of the broad topic of higher education, the practical impacts of the work that you're doing with Heterodox Academy. In your teaching, how do you practically encourage students to engage with ideas that challenge their own beliefs? And have you seen examples where the listening to understand model has actually changed someone's mind, shifted a classroom dynamic, something like that?
So I've tried to incorporate, I try all kinds of things to see what works, what doesn't work. One of the big assignments that my students have is to actually go out and have a conversation with someone that they know disagrees with them on a topic. And to really take a look at how they're having these conversations. Hmm. And then they have to write a reflection paper about it. What did I do well here? Where did I go completely off the rails here? What can I do better next time when I have a conversation? Hmm. I also have them read How to Have Impossible Conversations by James Lindsay and Peter Boghossian.
Okay.
And they hate reading it because honestly, it's very dry. And I was like, I'm always like, look, it's basically an instruction manual.
Okay.
And just, it's going to help you. And it does. When they start to think through the things that Lindsay and Boghossian spell out for them, yeah. Like, oh yeah, this really is very helpful. This really is a good idea. And they start to incorporate those into their conversations more. I also have them in class get together in a group and discuss the topic. And so their favorite thing to, like last semester, we started with parental advisory labels on albums, and which seems really innocuous, right? At this point in history, of course, back in the 80s, it was like, oh my God. And from a libertarian free speech perspective, it's still sort of, oh my God. Mm-hmm. For them to discuss whether or not they thought that that was a good idea, whether it was actually a form of government censorship. Mm-hmm. And so they start out these really broad, general, sort of generic, it's not a big deal, nobody cares, it's just a sticker.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have to get them to kind of focus in closer and closer and closer and narrow down their perspective on what does this really mean? Mm. Well, this is essentially government coercion on these record labels to say, here's an album that maybe your kids shouldn't listen to. And shouldn't the parents be listening to the album themselves and deciding for themselves what their kids should be listening to? You know, the government says you have to do this. The record label can comply or not comply, but can they really comply or not comply? You know, is there some sort of unseen force being exerted there? Probably, right? So getting them to actually getting to the nuances of this conversation and really look more closely at the details and understanding what things mean. So we read some John Stuart Mill, and Mill says, you know, if you are fully confident and understand your side of the argument, but not the other side, you don't really understand your own side either.
Oh, mm-hmm.
So in order to be better educated and better understand why you believe what you believe, you have to look at it all the way around. And so they apply this to their conversations with people, and many of them have changed their minds about the way that they view things. My goal always is to have them, you know, whatever side they're on at the beginning of the semester, I want them all living firmly in the middle by the end of the semester so that they always have a difficult time deciding how they view something without doing more investigation on it, to kind of help eliminate those knee-jerk reactions to things. And most of my students have come back and said, yes, this is, I absolutely do things this way now. I'm always trying to figure out why somebody sees things differently than I do. I'm trying to understand it. I've given the books we read in class to family members as Christmas gifts. I had a couple of students say that it's their favorite class they've ever taken at Western. It's completely changed the way that they do everything. So for me, that's very gratifying, obviously. Do all students come out of it the same way? No, I'm not going to reach everybody. The ideas aren't going to plant themselves as firmly with some people, and that's fine. But they do try, and they have, I think more of them have been changed by it than not. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I'm glad that you're doing that work with, even if it's a small number of people every year, that's great that that's happening.
Thank you.
So maybe we'll kind of start to wrap up and just sort of ask people who are interested in Heterodox Academy. And this is something where you have like sort of a chapter of it, right? So this is a national or international organization.
It is international now. Yeah, there are groups in there are members from Canada, the UK. I think that I met a gentleman from Hong Kong.
Oh, cool.
I might be mistaken about his precise location. I met him very briefly at the conference last year. So apologies. there. But yes, it's an international organization that is made up of professors, staff, graduate students, part-time instructors who are dedicated to promoting open inquiry, viewpoint diversity, and constructive disagreement on campuses to try to help round out the perspectives there and get a more balanced environment for students.
Cool. And people who are interested in checking out Heterodox Academy, where would they find that?
They can Google Heterodox Academy. It is, you have to be, have some kind of affiliation with a university or a college. Community colleges are also welcome in order to join. But the resources on their website are available to the public, and all of the information is there. What is the URL, you ask? I can tell you that it's heterodoxacademy.org.
Okay. Awesome. Well, and people who are interested in following you, getting more of your perspective, is there a way for them to do that?
You can follow my death and dying perspective on my Substack, which is The End. You can Google me, Jennifer Townsend, in relation to WMU. My email and contact information is all publicly available there. You can follow me on social media if you really want to. I think people might think I'm more interesting than I actually am, but
I was going to say that I follow you on Instagram, but it's a little more personal than academic, which is fine.
Yeah, so I do have two different Instagram accounts that are dedicated entirely to my death and dying, education work. And then I have too many Instagram accounts, but I try to keep my topics separate. I have an account that is also just a book account where all the murder mysteries I ever read go up there, but I also do try to post my HXA and viewpoint diversity work on campus to that account as well. So, Instagram, you can go from there.
Yeah, I'll try to collect some of these links that'll be in the notes for people who want to check about, including some of the books that we've mentioned, which I think would be some great stuff to get a hold of for people. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for making time to talk with Libertarian Christian Podcast. And I wish you a lot of luck in the work that you're doing, and I hope you keep doing it.
Thank you very much, Cody. Thank you for inviting me. And I hope that it was not a waste of anyone's hour. I very much enjoyed the conversation, though. Thank you.
Certainly wasn't a waste of mine, and I suspect that other people will feel the same way. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you liked today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.